Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's Open Systems Media eCast titled DME Innovations, Where is DME Headed? This eCast is sponsored by Contron, GE Intelligent Platforms, Elma Bustronic, and Emerson Network Power Embedded Computing. My name is Jerry Gipper. I am the Editorial Director for VME and Critical Systems, and I'll be moderating today's event. Before we start, I'd like to point out a couple of items you need to note about your eCast viewer console. First, please note the submit question area. At the end of the presentations, we will address selected questions as time permits. You can submit your questions at any time during today's session, and we welcome those questions. Second, please notice the Enlarge Slides button. This enlarges your view of the slides as they are presented and makes it much easier for you to view the material. With that, let's go ahead and get started with today's eCast. VME just celebrated 30 years of excellence, but where is it headed next? Developers of the VME bus specification have managed to provide new innovation that has kept pace with today's most current technology. For many years, developers have been able to utilize more bandwidth out of the parallel VME bus. In recent years, serial switch fabric technology was paired up with VME bus to provide a backwards compatible pathway to the higher speeds provided by today's latest serial interconnects. The new architectures that emerged, VXS first and later VPX, provide ever-increasing bandwidth and performance. Join us as we bring you the industry experts on VME innovation and learn from them what we can expect next. Before we start with the presenters, I'd like to just kind of cover the VME, the Vita technology roadmap. This is a picture of the roadmap that the Vita organization, which is responsible for maintaining the standards around VME and VPX and other technologies, maintains. And this kind of shows the legacy of the 30 years of VME, where it started out as a 32-bit bus, going to a 64-bit bus with extensions, and then eventually VME 2ESST, which allowed us to take the bus performance up to 320 megabytes per second. Over the evolution of this bus, the designers tried to make this backwards compatible and maintain the parallel interface as they slowly started to introduce the various switch fabrics, first with gigabit Ethernet on P0 connector, and then with Ethernet and other serial protocols on a P0 connector under the title of VXS. Then a few years back, they introduced VPX, which allowed you to continue the serial fabrics, but at the same time provide for hybrid parallel backplanes that would use the new pinout. And then the last thing that's being currently worked on by some of the members of Vita is the Vita architectures for optical. And here they're starting to study what are the things that need to be done to incorporate optical interconnects into backplanes in the future. You'll start to see some of that early work with the recent work that's been announced on what they call Vita 66, providing optical interconnects to a VPX backplane. The other thing I'd like to point out is this eye chart, and I don't intend for anybody to try to read this while we're doing this, but this is just to give you some indication of the amount of activity going on right now in the Vita organization with standards that cover everything from the core technologies on VME bus up to the interconnects and fabrics, mezzanines and different modules and small form factors, support and packaging, and then systems specifications that they're working on. So as you can see, there's a long list of things that are being worked on within the Vita organization. So that's it for my quick introduction. What I'd like to do is introduce our speakers. Our speakers today are Paul Virgil from Emerson Network Power Embedded Computing, Vincent Chaffeau from Contron, Michael Monroe from Elma Bustronic, and David Pepper from GE Intelligent Platforms. Our first speaker is going to be Paul. Paul leads the marketing efforts to military, aerospace, government, industrial, medical, and automation industries for the embedded computing business of Emerson Network Power. He joined Emerson with its acquisition of Motorola's Embedded Computing Group in January of 2008 and brings more than 30 years of experience in the industry to his current role. Paul is the author of numerous articles on embedded computers and backplane standards and has spoken on these subjects at several conferences over the years. He holds a bachelor's degree in electrical and electronic engineering from Portsmouth University in the United Kingdom. With that, Paul, I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you, Jerry, and welcome, everybody. Some of the other guest speakers here will talk more about architectural and specification issues and advancements that we're seeing in the future. What I want to talk about is define the laws of physics and some of the major advancements in semiconductors that may well affect our vision for Vita, the Vita suite of specifications that Jerry's just talked about, and the impact on some of the targeted application spaces that this industry and these technologies have been focused on. So my first slide here is something everybody will be familiar with, Moore's Law. So if you analyze Moore's Law, there's really three variables in this statement, and that is about the number of transistors that can be economically produced in silicon doubling every 2 years. So there's a quantification in there, there's a time frame variable in there, and we'll talk about that through the next few slides. But if you look at the key benefits that people expect to get out of Moore's Law, in terms of lower device power, that's becoming false. In terms of higher clock frequency with each technology node, that's becoming false. Higher performance with each technology node is still true, as is, you know, a fairly stable price per chip, which, you know, somewhat is managed by the vendors of the silicon, but it's obviously got underlying costs that are continued to drive down to a common point. So parts of the foundation of Moore's Law are becoming challenged, and while that's kind of been the mantra that we've all followed in terms of building embedded compute solutions for the next 40 years, it's questionable whether that trend is actually going to continue, you know, as we look at the future. So let's just talk about, you know, what's impacting the trend. With every scaling down of the silicon solution, things like leakage currents, reliability, tunneling effects, and quantum effects, and the challenges of manufacturing smaller and smaller dies is beginning to become, you know, prohibitive economically. This article in EE Times, this was as recently as October 2011, talked about how the industry can see how they can get down to 7-nanometer technologies over the next 10 years. But once you get beyond 7 nanometers, it is not really an issue of physics. It's all about economics, because you're now beginning to deal with molecular manipulation. This is very prohibitive, you know, from a cost point of view, all of which then turns into, you know, component costs and products that we're all trying to take advantage of. In a statement from the semiconductor industry, they're predicting that the rate of change, meaning the shrinking of dies, is going to slow by 50% as soon as a year from now. So we've been all used to a cadence of every 2 years under Moore's Law of die shrinks, and this is actually going to slow down, and I've got a slide later that talks about this. So another thing I think that is certainly going to influence, you know, how we identify the path forward for Vita is ARM technology. Now, this may be a surprising subject to bring up here. Certainly the processor technologies that have largely been utilized in Vita technologies to date have been Freescale and Intel general purpose processors. But I think we need to understand the impact that ARM technology is actually going to have on the expectations of the industry, our customers, and how this will then, you know, be taken into account as the Vita specifications continue to evolve. So let's just look at some statistics here. Over 10 billion ARM processors have shipped since 2008. It's surprising, there's only 7 billion people in the world, so it gives you a sense of the pervasiveness of ARM technology into applications, a lot of which are out of sight to us. It's the foundation technology inside your cellular devices like phones and technologies like this. And because what it drives are expectations around power and hence, you know, battery life, size, weight, power considerations, this is going to begin to influence what customers demand from technologies that utilize semiconductor and will certainly put pressure onto, you know, all of the semiconductor providers. If you look at ARM technology, it's now available in single and dual cores. 64-bit cores are available. It's now got committed support from Microsoft and Phoenix Technologies, and there's a refocusing on alternative applications, you know, starting to break out from that kind of pigeonholing of wireless technology devices. I realize these charts on the right here are a little bit hard to read, but it's a fairly simple message. If you look at the products that are on the market today in the ARM space, which is the set of dots kind of in the middle of the chart, it's telling us that there's a variety of products already available today that are all in the 1 to 1.5 watt per processor range. And clearly that's a, it could be an order of magnitude lower than some of the traditional processors. The chart below it is a cost chart. And again, that cluster of circled products there of an ARM basis are all in the $10 to $15 per component range. So you can see a completely different cost point, a significantly different power point. So ARM sets the expectations of what can be achieved in lower power in embedded computing. Lower power, of course, leads to smaller size. Smaller size leads to lower weight. And here we are now beginning to address some of the size, weight, and power issues that have been, you know, part of the mission for the Vita vendors here in solving classes of applications like unmanned vehicles, unattended locations, man-wearable computing. All of these things demand size, weight, and power reductions. And because the market can see what things like ARM can produce, there will be back pressure into finding ways to adopt technologies like that or to force the generalized processor technologies that we're used to using, again, Freescale, Intel, general purpose processors, to move towards these kinds of deliverables. Let's also talk about some other influences that are going on. Memory, for instance. Now, again, some more startling facts here, that there's actually competition now within the fabs for flash over dynamic RAM. So NAND flash, if you can read this article here from Semiconductor Manufacturing Design, this is from September 2011. So again, this is all pretty up-to-date kind of data points, is that NAND flash is growing 23% between 2010 and 2011, is planned to grow another 15% from 2011 to 2012. In that period of time, traditional DRAM memory is flat, and so vendors of this are obviously going to switch their lines over to growth technologies, and certainly there is an expectation that flash is going to overtake DRAM in the very near future. And certainly this will have an impact, you know, as we look at products and architectures to take advantage of this kind of memory. If we go on and look at the fact that there's also a drive to completely alternative kinds of memory, and this is coming from the server market. Now, servers are not a traditional market for the Vita technologies, but if you look at the huge market for servers and what it's driving in terms of the need for reduced power consumption, higher capacity, reduced space, which again are the size, weight, and power issues that we all care about in this world, there is certainly going to be an influence. What that's driving today is the establishment of at least three new memory technologies that are being considered. Graphene magnetic memory, which graphene is a basic constituent of graphite. This technology allows for a creation of a honeycomb sheet of a single layer of carbon atoms. And this is 200 times as strong as steel and conducts electricity at room temperature better than any material known. So you can see that this has got all kinds of exciting opportunities in terms of creating memory that certainly is going to provide much lower power, non-volatile storage capability than what we have today, and therefore challenge DRAM as being the traditional memory of choice. Another technology come along is phase change memory. This relies upon a physical or chemical change within the device. And again, this is likely to be substantially lower in power than traditional memory devices in this space. And then the last one is hybrid memory cube, which utilizes existing memory technology but stacks memory one on top of the other using through silicon vias. And the big advantage of this stacking is not only is it fairly space efficient, but you can save substantial amounts of energy because all of the I.O. circuitry that you typically would surround memory arrays with can be dispensed with largely because of this direct, you know, via contact between memory devices. One more technology that's certainly looking very interesting is memristor technology. Now, today, this is being looked at for memory devices. In fact, again, an article here as recently as October from HP talks about how this is going to be commercially available as soon as 2013 to implement memory configurations and again, for much higher density and lower power considerations. There's also the vision that this can be applied to essentially replace transistors, although using it for logic applications is expected to be something like 10 years away, but the momentum is there and the direction is set. And the interesting thing about technologies like this is that putting disk drives onto VITA boards or VME boards as integrated components is now looking to be a far easier implementation than leveraging existing technologies. So the last slide is, of course, the question of is there no more more? And, you know, there's a couple of useful references here in this diagram here. You can see the march forward on the technology node and the scaling down of silicon. Today we're in that 32 nanometer going down to 22 nanometer kind of world. And you can see that once we get past that, the cadence of every 2 years begins to slip out. We get into a three-year cadence, which means it's going to take us to 2019 to get down to 8 nanometer kinds of technologies. Another thing that you should observe from this is, well, you know, going from 16 to 8 is a halving of the scaling. If you look at these blue boxes in the center of the slide here, it shows with each one of those steps, you're actually going down to a quarter of the real estate or physical size of the implementation here. And I'm not sure if this actually shows up on your screen, but right down in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a little red dot. That's the relative sizing of a single silicon crystal. And so you can see as we get down to much smaller geometries like 4 nanometers, we're getting, you know, close now down to molecular physics in terms of implementing these single cells. And these are the big economic challenges that I think will disrupt what we've been used to in terms of Moore's Law. So, you know, what comes after Moore's Law, I'm not sure, you know, I want to, you know, soothsay here, but hopefully as an introduction here, giving you an indication that there's a number of different technologies that are coming within the semiconductor world that we certainly need to understand enough to be able to take into consideration as the VITA specifications continue to evolve. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. That looks like we got some real challenges ahead of us there with some of the new technologies coming out, and it'll be exciting to see that in some of the future generation products. Our next speaker is Vincent Chaffault from Contron. Vincent has over 20 years of experience in computer software and hardware development. This includes early VME PowerPC and PCI single board computer projects and Unix computer graphics hardware and software, where he discovered the open source practices and virtues of technical partnership between competing COTS vendors. He now leads the military product management for Contron. Vincent?
Hello. Welcome, everybody. So I am very pleased to be part of this webinar, especially with all the very insightful information that was given by our previous presenter. And my approach to after the laws of physics and the law of economics will be to be like a pragmatic approach, and to give you some pointers on what is on your plate for the next, say, 10 years in embedded computing, using VITA standards and using the good old laws that have been guiding us in this industry for the last 20 years. A lot of them will still be applicable to both VME and VPX because they are made of good sense. So if we start with something that I was wondering, when people start to VPX from VME, they are always asking what will be remaining in the future, what will be disappearing in the future. For sure, that's what we can say now, is that the TCP IP Ethernet, so it's something that will stick forever, at the scale of innovation, I mean. We have all started our career at the time where the only way to communicate between intelligent pieces of epoxy was a serial line. And by according to the last 5-6 years and until into the next 20 years, this ubiquitous way of communicating simple, efficient information will be a TCP IP and Ethernet. So good news is that when you come from VME, you have started to enjoy the P0 and the gigabit on the backplane, and software architecture have also evolved even in very complex multi-blade architecture and computers to accommodate the numerous technology that have been put on top of TCP/IP to remote control pieces of applications or receive data from sensor or whatever. So there was an advice to give to people designing new architecture into the future, even if they are cross-migrating from VME to VPX, a good common sense is to look where is the control plane in your architecture, both on the software side and on the hardware side. You have to use this as the backbone of your architecture and be sure that you will never break this, whatever the form factor, the swap C and whatever. So stick to a control plane policy for your custom-made boards. Make sure that they can accommodate both the 3U and 6U OpenVPX profile. So if you can do a simple thing with configuration resistors so that your control TCP/IP control plane can be fed to P1 on the VPX or on P4, then you're on safe grounds. You'll be able to fit almost all kinds of computer in the future and be sure that any piece of software can remote control your board, whatever custom it is. If we look also into the into this kind of a frame of mind, using TCP/IP and other kind of technology to move data from sensor to the computer or within the computer is kind of I would say cover 80% of the needs, especially looking forward into what VPX brings to us in terms of speed of links. We are talking about gigabytes and terabytes, and this is enough to consider that some of the specialized technology, serial rapid I/O or InfiniBand or even Raceway or Raceway Plus, are no longer needed for a vast majority of applications. Even very, very data greedy application can reasonably operate well within the scope of TCP/IP. That's one of the benefits we see in the future, and looking forward to have on the backplane things like 10 gigabit Ethernet or even 40 gigabit Ethernet that is starting to be implemented in telcos in ATCA form factor. That's why we have implemented what we call VX Fabric, which is in a way some piece of software implemented as a driver in the kernel. So it's completely hidden from application, which makes application TCP/IP packet fed to a socket go along the PCI Express lane on the backplane and be able to feed every kind of other boards. So in a way, people can write the application safely using TCP/IP sockets, and with the previous note on the control plane, your code will be very portable, whatever the form factor, whatever the vendor, and whatever the architecture you have in mind. The next slide is about swap-C, swap size, weight, and power. Is something that we have already covered in the previous speaker section. And what I call swap-C for VPX it's more or less the great pity, because if you have taken some time to look into OpenVPX backplanes, OpenVPX products, you clearly see that you have to make at some point some kind of choice between 6U or 3U. And in a way, it may be a big problem, because the technology on its own, and especially looking forward into denser flash, denser RAM, and everything like that, is really calling for a reduction in size. But in some application like fighters, carrier, and everything, the previous 10, 20 years of VME 6U have carved a niche and holes and boxes that look like they are only 6U. So what would you do if you had to plan for the future? Would you still want to design your application into the 6U box? It really makes sense because probably you already have the mechanics, you have the cables, you have everything. But if you go that route and don't pay attention to design an architecture which can be also compatible with the 3U side of VPX, then when you want and you can take the benefit of shrinking your size into a 3U, you will not be able to do it. And that's even more explained in the next slide. We, if you look into a computer today, you probably start from an application where you have qualified a rack, qualified an enclosure for a very extreme application, and this takes years and a lot of money. So you can still, for God's sake, that the VPX has been careful enough to retain the same 6U form factor at previous VME. So changing the backplane, those boards should be okay. Then you can start using 6U VPX boards in there. The trick is to be able to select boards and custom boards and single board computer boards and kits that can also be implemented later in 3U. If you do that, you'll be able very quickly to use your existing box. You have to remember that VPX allows you to freely mix 6U and 3U VPX boards on 6U or 3U backplanes, and you have to play with that clever trick that the OpenVPX and VPX standard makes to plan the future. You can start with the big boxes. You can qualify and ship a couple of samples of this computer to your customer, get the big contract, and if you carefully design the core of your computer using 6U and 3U compatible products, then you'll be able to deploy a winning 3U version of your final computer. That is not terribly difficult to do. Again, as I told you before, be careful where you put your control plane because that's basically what you will have to take care about. And again, make sure that things, custom things and standard things get really well segregated in your architecture. Let's have a look at that in the next slide. If you look at this slide, you will see on the right kind of a big computer which is mixing 3U and 6U boards. That's perfectly valid with the VPX standard. And in this case, the approach that we have with a lot of key customers today is to help them reuse one of their 6U custom boards into these kind of systems, but at the same time benefit from the swap, the size reduction in the single board computers, carriers, and other things to make sure that they can use a very small form factor core computer. The computer baseline at the top, what is written generic computer, is what the board vendor can bring to you. The board vendor will qualify along with backplanes a complete functional computer, even using very sophisticated end-to-end technology that the 10 gigabit Ethernet requires, for example. If you want to succeed in that, you make sure that the boards, the backplane, the connectors, everything has been validated together. And on the other end, if you are doing a very specific application, you'd like also to take benefit of the other connectors to do your own business of very sophisticated I/O between bunch of FPGA, for example, and so forth. So again, if you remember the word of VME with the P2 that was dedicated more or less to application-specific I/Os, if you look back into the compact PCI, not so old, with the P3, P4, P5, which is also dedicated to I/Os, OpenVPX has also dedicated those P4, P5 for custom application. And the approach would be to have a validated computer from the board vendors, your application-specific I/Os on another piece of the backplane. And in this case, you can even imagine solutions where a 3U backplane is used for the computer and another piece of backplane is used for the application-specific I/Os. In this case, you're really going to leverage what the computer vendor has already validated for you while being on your own and free to select the right technology for the backplane itself, for your application-specific IOs. That is something important, and that can only be done now because we have a standard which allows mechanically and safely to mix 3U and 6U boards. So you don't have to look for 6U boards for everything like payload and switches. You can use a 3U switch and 6U payloads and vice versa, provided you carefully design your architecture first. Then in the next, one of the questions in the next slide is how flexible is the VPX? If you look back into VME world, it was easy in this case not so long ago to buy a standard backplane and later design the architecture of the computer. With VPX and the point-to-point connection, you need to establish links from one board to the next board. If you look at how OpenVPX addresses that, it addresses that with backplanes that we have learned to look into these visual drawings, like on the lower left of my slides, trying to interpret is this PCI Express data plane lane is going to the slot 7 and what if I put a carrier in slot 3, whatever. What you have to remember is that provided you, for the early days, the early steps of your architecture design, you take care of having a switch somewhere, like in this case a PCI Express switch, you can see that all the architecture that are on the lower right in this slide can be implemented with this exact same hardware. Just by logical programmation of the PCI Express switch on the last slot in this case, you can achieve either a peer-to-peer or a relationship between a gang of SBCs or on the second line, one SBC controlling a lot of IO boards, or even more sophisticated, two clusters of SBCs and each of them having two IO boards and so forth. So again, you are not condemned to have to suffer one different backplane for one different application. There is a lot of things that are in play now, that are available, that you can use in order to remove some of the constraints you see in these point-to-point architectures. In the next two slides, it's kind of easy. Again, back to basics. If we want to have a good way into the future with existing architecture, the good old trick for board computers is to have generation of board computers compatible with the previous generation of board computers and so forth. In this case, on this 3U VPX line of single board computers from Control, you can see that how careful we were to be sure that the subsequent products on the product line would be backward compatible on a pinout basis to the previous generation. So you don't have to freak if you have to commit to backplane now, because it will still be applicable to the next super duper 8 nano generation of computers boards in the future. And again, these good old tricks still apply in the VME world. VME will not disappear. And we have made sure with Contron, we were just talking minutes ago about the ARM technology, that whatever the processor architecture, PowerPC, AES86 or ARM in VME, we will make sure that you can jump ship with your application on the chip side without having to redo your custom backplane, your cabling and everything, and we make sure that the front panels of our every 6U VME boards and the backplane pinout is the same whatever the processor. So most of the big integrators today have product lines in radar, sonar, whatever there are. Some of them have already converted to Intel architecture. Some of them are still in PowerPC. Another line would like to go ARM. Again, with a couple of precautions from the board vendors to keep this thing alive, like pinout compatibility, you are in good hands to be able to design your system once and for all and choose the application later according to your power of porting this application and availability of software engineers. That was my message to you. Board vendors will be there and Control with them to accompany you to transitioning from the old world to the new world, and to make sure that there is always a transition path for you to go forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Vincent. That was very good. A lot of information there. Our next speaker is Michael Monroe at the Elma Bustronic. He's a technical specialist there. In addition to over 20 years of experience in the packaging and interconnect industry, Michael is a very active member of the VITA Standards Organization, a professional member of the IEEE, and serves as Secretary-Treasurer of PICMAC. Michael, you're up.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you to Open Systems Media for sponsoring this, along with the other presenters. VME, of all the embedded computer architectures, really, VME has been the most successful at continually reinventing itself as we've moved from 32-bit VME to what today is Open VPX. And it's this migration that allows us to continue to serve the demanding needs of the military, aerospace, and industrial marketplace. I want to talk a little bit about the elements of the VME VME architecture as it's incorporated as Open VPX that continue to make this architecture particularly strong. First of all, it's the substantial ecosystem that already exists with Open VPX boards. There are now something like 28 different backplane profiles supporting some 40 different module profiles. So this continually expanding ecosystem is extremely important to our customer base and is what makes Open VPX an exciting architecture to work in. Continuing from earlier VME generations, the PMC, XMC, and now FMC mezzanines that are still compatible with the Eurocard architecture that is also a strong point makes this a very flexible architecture. I'm going to talk a little bit about some new standards that are being implemented in VPX, which involves RF and optical modules that allow through the backplane communication, and this is going to help carry VME into the future. Level 2 maintenance is supported by the VITA 48 specification, which is an entirely new mechanical spec. It builds on IEEE 1101.10, but adds completely enclosed modules so that you can change modules in exposed areas like out in the field or on a carrier deck, and there's protection for the connectors if you drop them. And along with that is the support of the cooling that is needed to handle the substantial power that's possible in these cards. There are cabling systems both for the optical and RF modules, but there's also now cabling systems that support the development activities which have been made complicated by the point-to-point architecture of OpenVPX, but are also part of what makes the OpenVPX system flexible. Cooling systems, there are now a number of different cooling solutions that are part of that VITA 48 standard that I just mentioned, and I'll mention that a little bit more in a later slide. And then some of the very near-term future developments will be the development of system management on OpenVPX, which is going to allow the management of diverse system resources remotely, the monitoring of power and the overall system availability, and to do things like help manage firmware and software updates on the individual boards. Another development is there are now several activities going on within VITA that we're participating on that are going to result in small form factors that are going to be compatible with the VPX architecture as well. So supporting to make all of this possible, there's well over 1,000 pages of standards. I think there's some 14 different documents that have already been released to a series of dot specs around VITA 46. which handle different types of I/O protocols. Then there is standards for rear transition modules, a group of standards related to the packaging that provide for conduction, convection, air flow through, and soon liquid flow through cooling systems. And there's also, as I mentioned, there's some new standards that are very close to being released that will handle optical and RF connections through the backplane. One that is also very important to all of us within the VITA community is VITA 68. It's hoped that this will be released sometime during late Q1 or early Q2 of next year, and that's the electrical channel requirements. The ability of VPX to support speeds of up to 8 and 10 gigabits per second per lane is only possible by having a very carefully defined channel requirements, and this is an ongoing effort within VITA, and I think this VITA 68 document is going to be useful to large segments of our industry as it gets more and more important to define the electrical channel. So the higher speeds I've just been talking about for VITA 68 also involve going off the backplane with new standards for I/O connectors to support these speeds. Today, there's a number of choices for I/O cabling up to 10 gigabits per lane, and there are backplanes being built currently that do in the neighborhood of 25 gigabits for a by-4 fat pipe. So I said that the VITA 65, which is the open VPX spec that builds on the earlier VITA 46, was released with something like 28 different developmental backplane profiles. There's a release 2 of VITA 65 that should be released very near to the end of this year. It's in its second round of ANSI balloting, and it will add another 10 profiles. In gray, you can see the number of additional profiles that are being developed. It's going to bring the number of slot profiles to something like 47, and this the interest in the suppliers of VPX hardware to defining new module and backplane profiles represents a growth of product, available product in the ecosystem. The XMC standard was developed towards the end of the earlier VME 64 extensions product lifetime, and those XMC mezzanine cards are just as valid today and are a very important part of the open VPX ecosystem. In addition to the existing XMC mezzanines or even simpler mezzanines to support the addition of FPGA modules on top of the base carrier card, and that's the new FMC mezzanine, which I think you're going to see adding a lot to the functionality of both 3U and 6U modules in the near future. I mentioned the RF and optical extensions. Although those two specs are not finalized yet, they are very close to being finalized, and as a supporter of these, ELMA has already begun introducing products and supporting customer needs for both the RF and the optical modules. There's a number of different formats in which you can have it, but we are supporting the four coaxial backplane connections on 3U slots, and although eight is also possible, and we're supporting eight of these coaxial connectors on 6U boards. We've recently just, I think, released our first product to a customer with the new VITA 66.1 optical interconnect, and that makes use of the popular MT ferrule and cabling system that will allow us to put in a single, replace a single connector position on a six-shoe or a three-U card with a module that will carry either one or two MT ferrules. This means that you can have in replacing one of these one-inch long 16 wafer modules on either 3U or 6U card with optical cabling supporting up to either a single 12 fiber MT ferrule or two MT ferrules each with 12 or 24 fibers. So you could have 48 fibers in a single connection, and that's enough to do easily a very large mesh in the confines of a VPX system. And that would still take advantage of all the power that's available, up to 380 watts on a card, which technology, until we have liquid flow through cooling, we won't even be able to begin to touch that type of available power per slot. So there is a wide variety of packaging available. In addition to the very well-known standard 19-inch equipment rack system with convection cooling, the support of Vita 48 is allowing much more standardized, rugged modules that can support level 2 maintenance requirements. So, what does it look like? The backplanes look very similar. They have substantial. They have guide pins. They have coating per slot. There are 3U and 6U modules, as Vincent has talked about in his presentation. There are development backplanes that are available to support the integration of 3U and 6U cards, just as Vincent was describing. And there is a growing number of backplane topologies to support customer needs, supporting multiple data planes on the same backplane, the very important control plane, which I agree will probably remain Ethernet for many years to come. But this is together makes a very capable and substantial system. So when you have a point-to-point architecture, instead of a parallel architecture, although you have the ability to bring an awful lot of data into the system, it does create challenges to system integrators who are trying to select and integrate card sets together before they finalize their eventual target platform. To support those activities, it begins to become necessary now to either create custom backplanes during the development process or have a way of implementing flexible architectures during this development process before you define a final backplane. A lot of times in final systems, there isn't room for rear RTMs. There's very little room for rear cabling even. So we need a system that allows us to do flexible architectures during the development process. And the development of the multi-gig compatible cabling system that is available from ELMA allows us to implement both meshes and star architectures on power and ground only backplanes that allow us to make decisions and work with cards to see how many slots we need and what is the required data flow from card to card before we implement the final architecture in a finished backplane. Also, you'll see more and more rigid flex rigid designs because the I/O capability of the 3U or 6U slot is tremendous and will be one of the real strengths of VPX, the amount of I/O that's possible. But that means that with high-speed requirements, there will be more and more I/O solutions that will be customized using rigid flex rigid designs. Pictured up in the right-hand corner is the kind of, let me go back there. It is a kind of development box that allows people to work on cards and have access to either side. I said one of the really near-term developments that we're working on is within both the VFO community, our own development labs. We're working on a number of different small form factor solutions that will allow Vita architectures to address space and weight constrained applications in the future. So that's our vision of OpenVPX, and Jerry, back to you.
Thank you, Michael. Our final speaker is David Pepper with the GE Intelligent Platforms. David has been working in product management the past 13 years, primarily focused on standard PicMeg and Vita form factors using a combination of Freescale and Intel processors. Current efforts are toward achieving the highest compute densities possible in these form factors while continuing to recognize the need to address the size, weight, and power concerns of the customers. Prior to GE, David spent 19 years at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, most of that time as a development manager over the Space Lab Payload Crew Training Complex. Sounds interesting. David has a BS from Athens State University and an MS from Southeastern Institute of Technology. David?
Thank you, Jerry. Just get right into it quickly here. You know, why has VME stuck around for 30 years? Well, its customers have had investment protection, and the technology has evolved accordingly. We had a good discussion earlier regarding Moore's Law. So if you think about it, if you look at a product line, for example, the picture here, PPC2A, going back to the late 90s, based on several generations ago, Freescale technology, the technology has evolved over time, but also what has happened in the latter 2000s time frame, 2006-2007 time frame, we stepped up from the VME 64 to 2ESST, which gave us the boost then from really effectively around 100, you know, 160 megabytes maybe theoretically per second, but we do have 320 megabytes per second available to us with 2ESST, and that's a real number. I've seen benchmarks easily run burst transfers, you know, trending above 300 megabytes a second. So I didn't, although the VME protocol has persevered, that's not what I meant to say. It's actually been preserved, 2ESST being a superset. So really customers have been able to move forward. They've been able to move forward with the processing technology, and then they've also been able to move forward with the VME technology. So we've actually got a case here. We've got a good, stable product, VME-based product, preservation of backplanes and investments and things of that nature. And for more than 10 generations of products, we've got, you know, a good thing. So this is why VME has been preserved and has persevered, if you will, for the past 30 years and probably for many more years to come. You think about it, you know, what is VPX? Well, it is like VME, as Michael just mentioned, that, you know, we still have common forms, 3U, 6U, for example. Using the speedometer analogy, it's obviously much faster, and that's partially what it's all about. And, you know, why would somebody choose VPX? Well, if you have very complicated system architectures, as displayed here, you know, you've got all kinds of things going on. I got high-speed sensors on the front end. I got platforms on the back end. In the middle of all that, I got data processors. I got signal processors. So if I'm trying to do all this within a given box, or it could be a set of boxes, and I have a very high speed of data that I need to move around, but at the same time, I could have some standard legacy I/O, for example. So, you know, you might have an opportunity in a system like this to actually mix VME for the existing parallel, and even the VME control plane, or the deterministic nature of it could be very advantageous to an application. But for those segments where you really need to move high amounts and high speed amounts of data, then, you know, you might find yourself needing to move forward to VPX. So it's really a good evolution in technology for us. And this is just an example system, is, you know, what you can really do with VPX. In this particular case, we're moving about greater than 2 gigabytes a second worth of data across the backplane, and we're able to do this because we really do have a high-speed data plane now that we can work with in VPX. So in this particular case, it's two channels of either 10 gig EE or it could be InfiniBand or any number of things on the data plane that's been defined via OpenVPX. And I couldn't do this kind of thing, you know, with a parallel architecture. I mean, it just couldn't scale to allow me to move this amount of data. So now I've got, you know, some very high-performant single-board computers, for example, using maybe Intel's latest technology. I might have some switches in the middle. And I've really got a quite performant system. I put a lot of data processing capability in this framework, but at the same time, I can move significant amounts of data with it. And, you know, one of the nice things I refer to it, if you had a need to do a hybrid system, and, you know, you could literally marry VME64 along with VXS and VPX in the same chassis. And, you know, you really, what you've done now is you've preserved your investment maybe in the VME I/O, or you already have, and for those higher speed, you know, newer generation devices, maybe they need to communicate via both the control plane, the data plane, and even possibly the expansion plane that OpenVPX defines. So you can really put together some very clever and interesting systems with, you know, bringing all the VITA standards together. And what is OpenVPX all about? Well, we just took a very broad set of standards. Michael referred to it. I mean, there's a lot of VITA 46 dot standards, and you know, we were able to boil that down, make it a little maybe easier to get your arms around it. Now you've got a set of slot profiles, you've got module profiles, whether it be payloads or switches or whatever they happen to be. And now you can take some confidence. Okay, I've got this module and I want to put it in this slot. And that's really what OpenVPX does. It defines those profiles. They can be added, as was stated. They can go forward. As technology evolves, as needs evolve, we can add new profiles into OpenVPX, and it becomes a very robust standard. It takes us well into the future. Okay, this is simple. So I intended to make mine pretty quick because I didn't have a lot of time, but somebody asked me to speculate, where are we and where we're headed. Well, VME obviously has been around for a while. It'll continue to be around. It is stable. It does give you good deterministic performance, and as stated, with 2ESST, we get up to 320 megabytes a second. Now we have VPX. We've introduced the serial fabrics. Choose your favorite fabric, whether it be PCI Express, SREO, 10 gig E, InfiniBand, or some fabric that's yet to be named that doesn't exist yet that will be defined soon. Who knows? But we know we can get more than 2 gigabytes a second, and clearly it'll scale beyond that. And then, as Michael mentioned, I mean, really the cool thing that I see coming, fiber optic. We can start really doing some things. We're seeing, you know, fiber optic is coming on, but at the same time, there's still the movement within the connector industry. I mean, I've seen specification on connectors that can take us well beyond 10 gigabits per second. So, you know, we're not going to run out of room on the connectors. That technology will evolve. We've got fiber optic coming on strong. It's getting a lot more practical to, you know, consider it in the backplane. Clearly, the interconnects, that's already happened. We start getting serious about doing it on the backplanes, and maybe a few years or generations of electronics from now, we'll actually see it, you know, in the physical electronics. But it's going to keep moving, and VITA and VME and VPX will keep adapting as it will as these technologies evolve. And that's it for me, Jerry.
Thank you, David. It looks like we've definitely got a lot to consider here as we go into the next generations of computing technology around the VITA architectures. I'd like to take and address just a couple of questions that have come in. I know we're running out of time here, so I'd like to kind of step through these fairly quickly. But to one of the questions, and I think I'm going to direct this to Vincent, is do the 6U and 3U backplanes have the same kind of performance capabilities? Is there any performance issues I need to worry about there?
Uh,
Definitely, yes. Yes, the performance is exactly the same on 3U or 6U. It's just you are looking at implementing the same architecture into a lower number of wafers, and so a lower number of signal pairs. And that should, looking at the theoretical performance of 10 gigabit Ethernet, can be implemented those days if you have a high quality backplane with just a couple of pairs of signals with a 10 gig base KR, then you may not need that many wafers. On the other end, if you have an application with multiple custom boards or multiple boards with multiple FPGAs talking to each other with a lot of IOs, you'll be down to the same kind of compromise you had to make with Compact PCI and VME and say, I must stay in 6U. Because I need those connections.
Okay. And one other question that kind of came up in a couple of presentations that kind of piqued my interest was on the discussion on the ARM technology. And I'll direct this to both Paul and to Vincent, maybe make a short comment on that. Can we expect to see ARM processors on some of these future boards, or are you just using ARM as an example of the type of power envelopes that you're looking for in processor families?
Well, I'll respond first. This is Paul Virgo. I mean, I think we'll see the influence of ARM before we'll see ARM specifically on boards. And as I mentioned in my presentation, I think it's going to drive the expectations of reduced size, weight, and power. But I think certainly there's no reason why those processors won't appear at some time. I think that it's probably a year or two ahead, though.
Okay. Vincent, any comments?
Yes. Yes, the attempt we are making, Canton has decided to implement all ARM products, and we'll be starting with this range of modules. So, you know, small credit card size modules will be done with ARM. ARM processors on it. So it'd certainly be an easy way for us to implement a carrier for those modules that would fit the 3U VPX backplane. It's not difficult. And especially knowing that there is a lot of buzz around ARM, and if you take young engineers out of university those days, they all want to work on ARM. There is no way you can prevent them from working on ARM, like in the year before they wanted to do TCP/IP.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up since we're at the end of our time limit here. Just a couple of takeaways that I got out of the presentation today were that we have a lot of Moore's Law challenges to face, and it'll be interesting to see how those are going to impact future developments using various speed of technologies. The second thing was if you're doing serial fabric architectures, be sure you choose wisely so that you can provide yourself a migration path as you go forward. Number three was there are going to be a lot of serial fabric options through VPX with lots of different combinations, so again, consider those wisely. And number four, it's exciting to see that fiber optics are finally starting to show up as solutions in some of the backplanes that we're talking about here, and hopefully we'll see some of the first major products using the fiber optic technology here in the very near future. I'd like to, today's event and previous ECASTs are, as always, archived in the Open Systems Media website. The archived ECAST can be replayed at your convenience, and today's event will be posted shortly. I would like to thank Paul, Vincent, Michael, and David for today's ECAST. I hope that you'll find this information helpful in making future design decisions, and I thank you for your participation in today's ECAST. I invite you to return for future events, and please pass the word to others who might benefit from this type of information. On behalf of Open Systems Media, have a great day and happy holidays.